I want to introduce to you the moderator of our next panel. She's an old friend and a terrific reporter for the Washington Post, Juliette Alperin, who's also the author of a terrific book that I'm actually reading right now, Demon Fish, about sharks. And she traveled the world. Oh, I don't know how you got the budget for that, Juliette, but it's a terrific book. And thank you for moderating this panel, which we lovingly call Fish Fight. Juliette Alperin.
Thanks so much, Jeff. So I know a lot of you are really interested in the oceans and particularly what's happening to the fish there and fisheries management. And so we have a great panel here with some of the people who are most deeply involved in looking at what's happening to the sea and what are the best ways for us to interact with it. And so we're just you have everybody with everyone's title, and I'm just going to start off. We're going to start with, of course, the NOAA administrator, Jane Lubchenco, who has was mentioned in the last panel, has submitted herself to our interrogation for three SEJ panels in a row. In the first panel, she was scrutinized for climate change policy in Madison. Then last year, of course, she was in the hot seat for the BP oil spill. And this time we've decided to, make her explain fisheries policy. So, she is not getting a free ride regardless of what happens in 2012. But so we're going to start right now. And each of the panelists is going to outline kind of in brief what they see as the greatest both challenges and possibilities that are facing us in terms of fisheries policy. And then I'll ask a couple of questions, and then we'll open it up for you all. So, Jane, if you wouldn't mind, just start.
Thanks, Juliet. Hi, everybody. I think this is going to be a very interesting discussion. As Jeff and Juliet indicated, the name of this panel is called Fish Fight. And I think from the outset, I want to reframe how we're thinking about this. One of my jobs at NOAA, one of my many jobs at NOAA, is to fight for fishermen and for fish. And I think that the fighting that we need to be doing is fighting for solutions to have sustainable fisheries and sustainable fishing jobs. This is a very, very tough economic climate. It is hard on everybody, but it's particularly hard on small businessmen. And whether the fishermen are commercial fishermen or recreational fishermen, these are very, very challenging times for them and for their communities and for the businesses that depend on them, whether it's processors or boat manufacturers, gear manufacturers. Fishermen do have a very tough time. At the same time, we are required by legislation, by the Magnuson-Stevens Act, to end overfishing and to rebuild fisheries in the U.S. Doing that is causing some very significant changes in the way we regulate fisheries. This has been going on for some time, but it's really building because by the end of this year, we are required to have in place limits for all the different fisheries that we regulate so that we will be ending overfishing and rebuilding fishing stocks. Now, that hammer is coming down, and that means that there are a lot of changes underway. We at NOAA have been approaching this collectively with fishermen, using the diversity of tools in our toolbox to try to align short-term and long-term incentives, to try to align economic and conservation incentives. And because many fishermen that I know and talk to frequently are genuinely concerned about not just the short-term but the long-term, they appreciate the importance of ending overfishing and of rebuilding fish stocks. So we are in this fight together. It's a fight for the present and the future. And many of the policies that are playing out different places around the U.S., and there are very different issues different places around the U.S., and there are different issues for recreational fishermen as well as commercial fishermen. But we at NOAA are working with fishermen to try to utilize the best available information to make the best decisions that will have durable fisheries for the long time and therefore durable fishing jobs. So I just want to make that by way of opening brief remarks, Julia.
Okay, perfect. I'm amazingly a political appointee who can keep to time, a rare occurrence in Washington, I can assure you. So next we will have Daniel Polly, who is both a professor of zoology and, he's a marine biologist, he's a professor at the Fisheries Center and Zoology Department at the University of British Columbia. Daniel has done, as many of you might be aware, some incredible, what's interesting is he both does incredible research about fisheries and really does kind of broad global analysis, but also helps really communicates to journalists and the public through, for example, the Sea Around Us project that some of you might be familiar with, which is very easy to, you can just Google it on the web. And I can testify that Daniel, you know, sure he does good science, but he is shameless at spinning reporters through sheer charm and an amazing accent. So don't get sucked in. I warn you that right now, the minute he starts speaking, you might think that he knows what he's talking about, you know, just by virtue of how he talks. But Daniel, give us a sense of what's going on.
Yeah. there are different ways of looking at fisheries, and usually it is a certain species at a certain place. So menhaden in Chesapeake Bay or sardine in Monterey. But another way of looking at it is as a system that supplies fish from the whole world to certain places, certain large markets. And to understand that system, we do the same thing in my project, the same thing a little bit as meteorologists do, which is to draw maps and show the winds. And people can understand maps very easily. And we have mapped the fisheries, the catches that come from different fisheries since the 50s, since 1950 actually. And you can actually see that the fisheries have expanded geographically over these six decades from the industrialized country mainly, and they have expanded at a rate of 1 million square kilometers in the first three decades. This is a nice number, 1 million square kilometer, and then in the 80s up to 3-4 million kilometers square in the 80s, and then the expansion subsided and is now essentially over, and that's because we have covered the world with fisheries. This is a very powerful notion, the idea of fisheries spreading, industrial fisheries actually, because they were artisanal fisheries everywhere, obviously, spreading, and 4 million square kilometers per year in the 80s, that's about the Amazon every year. So one Amazon every year, and now it's over. In addition to spreading in space, we spread in depth. That is a few 10 or 20 meters per whatever meters are per year, which we go further. And now the average we have lots of trawl fishing at what is it in feet at 2,000 feet, something that would have been impossible earlier. Also, we expanded the species that are exploited, and so the average fish is getting uglier because we're now landing fish that would never have been landed before. So tree expansion. What it means is that if the catch of the world is stable, which it isn't, but FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the world, tells us it is. If it is stable, but we are expanding, then we are losing fisheries everywhere. Because if we maintain the catch by expanding, it means that fisheries individually are going kaput. And the expansion is what keeps them going. That suggests that we don't have sustainability. Worldwide, we don't. If that is true, then in a market like the US or the EU, where 60-70% of the food is imported, in the EU is 80%, Japan 60%, 70%, like the US, then it means that the rebuilding that is now being undertaken in the US, the attempt at reform that is done in the devastated European fisheries, even in the Japanese fisheries, are not doing too well. But it will not be sufficient because also they will have, these big markets will have to export sustainability against the import of fish. That is that now in the US, most of the fish is imported that you eat. But if there is no sustainability in other countries, what will the future, where will you get your fish in the future? I could give this presentation, I could say that in Europe as well, or in Japan, and I have. Finally, a point I want to make about this, if this sustainability is a big issue, can we simply farm our way out of this problem with aquaculture? We could, but not with the aquaculture that we think about, because the aquaculture that we think about is aquaculture of carnivores, typically salmon, and we have to feed them anchovies and mackerels and ground-up herring to keep this going. And in other audiences in Europe, I would not have to argue that anchovies and sardine and stuff can be eaten by people because they can. In the US, you will have to learn it because this is the only reserve of fish that we actually have. And the form of aquaculture, that's my last point, that we in the West think as future, the salmon aquaculture doesn't have. And the big news in the last 2 days is that a particularly deadly form of a disease, salmon anemia, I think it's invasive salmon anemia, or some nasty term.
Pernicious
for that's even worse. Has been imported along with 30 million eggs of salmon into British Columbia. And those of you who know what it did to Chile, which is to destroy half of the production in Chile of the second major export of the country after copper, will appreciate what it means to have now this disease in BC. Aquaculture of carnivores is hopeless. It will not replace the fish that we do not export sustainably that are from wild fisheries. So sustainability is a big issue, and we have to fight for it because we don't have it yet.
Okay. Thank you so much. Now we have Steve Gaines, who's Dean of the Donald Brenn School of Environmental Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And obviously, when you cover the environment, often you're dealing with bad news stories. And Steve is going to be brave and try to explain why there might be some cause for optimism when it comes to fisheries. Go ahead.
Thank you, Juliet. Thank you, everyone, for coming. I'm sure there'll be a lot of disagreement that goes on in this conversation today, but I think one thing we can all agree on is that when overfishing occurs, fixing it benefits everyone. It leads to more fish in the sea, more fish being caught, and better livelihoods and recreational experiences by the people that catch them. So if that's true, if everybody benefits by fixing overfishing, why do we see around the world this repeated problem that you've had of fisheries getting into states of overfishing, and why is that so hard to get out? And I think there really are two fundamental reasons that have been driving this, and that these are the reasons for optimism, because there are good solutions to both that are either emerging or have been around for a while. The first is that we usually do not have the information we need to know when we're getting into trouble. And so we commonly fall into overfishing without realizing that the problem's happening. The second is that we have a variety of systems that create financial incentives that drive people at a variety of levels, fishermen and regulators, to do things in the short term which are not good for them in the long term. And so fixing both of these problems, I think, is really key, and I'm optimistic that we actually have solutions to both of them. On the data front, historically we've had to take stock of the status of fisheries by spending $1 million to do very detailed stock assessments. And this is not something you can do for the vast majority of fisheries on the planet. As a consequence, we commonly get into problems when we don't know what's happening. But really innovative new work that's coming out of primarily a bunch of really young new fishery scientists, including John O'Wilson at my own institution, who's come up with really creative ways of coming up with cheap, rapid ways of assessing the status of a fishery that commonly involve fishermen directly in the collection of the data and involved in management are really transforming, I think, the opportunities for us to be able to evaluate where the fishery is at the moment and make corrective action early in the process as opposed to having to deal with solving overfishing problems that have been pending and looming for a long time. The second is on the incentives front. And here I think there are a number of really interesting things that have been emerging both at the level of government and within the industry. There are a variety of ways that you can shift the incentives, as Jane talked about, and align short-term and long-term so that we focus on long-term sustainability and create economic incentives in the short run for long-term good stewardship. Some of this can be done by governments by putting more rights into fisheries management. There's a variety of ways that that can be done in terms of things like catch shares, but a variety of other forms of management approaches. Interestingly, though, there's also a whole variety of ways that this can be driven by industry itself and throughout the seafood industry. And I think a really interesting example here is Christopher Lofgren, who owns Bamboo Sushi in Portland, Oregon, who has come up with really innovative ways of thinking about long-term forward contracting with fishermen when they adopt various management reforms within the industry that are leading to a sustainable supply of fresh seafood for his restaurants and at the same time paying the fishermen higher revenues. And there's an emergence, I think, in both of these areas of fixing the data problem and fixing the incentive problems that make me really optimistic that we're going to be able to pick up the pace of reform and change the nature of the story in terms of fisheries.
Excellent. So now we have Jim Donofrio, who's the executive director of the Recreational Fishing Alliance. I'm sure, again, many reporters in the room have received emails from him from time to time over what policies are happening in Washington. And by the way, you'll notice it's no accident. We have it all depends on how you look at the spectrum. We have the scientist to my right and the fisherman to my left. But now we'll get a couple of different perspectives of folks who are in the field dealing with this. So, Jim, if you could.
Thank you, Juliet, and good morning, everybody, and thanks for coming out here today. In 1976, Congress took a bold step and created the 200-mile limit under the Magnuson-Stevens Act, throwing out all foreign fishing fleets which were depleting our waters of fish at an industrial rate. According to NOAA, the Magnuson-Stevens Act aided in the development of the domestic fishing industry by phasing out foreign fishing. Subsequently, the U.S. commercial fleets took off, with vessels now targeting stocks of fish while developing new fisheries over time. In the years that followed, there were very little management or oversight, although much encouragement from NOAA fisheries, including government incentives to modernize the commercial fleet in order to focus on harvesting so-called underutilized species. As you can imagine, the pendulum had swung. In 1996, the Sustainable Fisheries Act was implemented, an overreaction by Congress to address the rather unsustainable practices of the U.S. commercial fishing industry at that time. The problem with the new law, it created new definitions and arbitrary deadlines that had little to do with science-managed fisheries. To ratchet down harvest in the commercial sector, the pendulum swung to the other side. In 2006, more onerous and arbitrary measures were implemented in the newly reauthorized Magnuson Act. These measures have kept our anglers, our party charter boat fleet tied to the dock, forcing mom-and-pop tackle stores out of business while stifling a multi-billion-dollar American industry, all while we observe healthy, rebuilt fisheries in many different regions. Instead of coming back to the middle, the pendulum pushed even further, stifling our ability to meet the original intent of the Magnuson to aid in the development of a domestic U.S. fishing industry in both the commercial and recreational sector, while ensuring open access to healthy, sustainable fisheries. Now the federal government is intent on forcing us to use catch shares, an initiative to cap fishing participation and privatize stocks. Allowing monopolistic behavior in the recreational sector is a job killer. President Obama says he wants to create jobs, so we clearly don't understand why NOAA is trying to kill them with a catch share program. Clearly, privatizing recreational fish stocks is not the answer to managing sound, sustainable fisheries. And finally, and most importantly, our community is being regulated out of existence because the federal fisheries law is broken. Magnuson is broken, and on behalf of the fish and the fishermen, we believe it's time for Congress to dig in, fix the statutory problems within Magnuson, and bring the pendulum arm back in the middle where we can properly balance commerce and conservation. Thank you all.
Thanks so much, Jim. Now we'll move on to Nils Stolpe, who is both a consultant to the commercial fishing industry, primarily in New England, as well as a fish blogger with Fishnet USA, right? Is that the name of it? Nils will give his perspective on where he thinks we're headed, both in his area and nationwide.
Okay, thanks, Juliet. First off, as far as the possibilities, and I'm just talking domestic fisheries because that's what I know. We have plenty of fish. NOAA NIMS does an annual report to Congress. In essence, the report is what's called a sustainability index, how many of our fisheries have become sustainable, or sustainable in quotes. And the sustainability index has been going up at a fairly decent slope for 8 years, 10 years, something like that. We're in a good place with our fish resources now, and we're heading towards a better place. Unfortunately, the challenge is, how can we harvest these fish without irrevocably changing the character or destroying our fishing communities, our fishing businesses, and our fishing families? And this is both commercial and recreational. As Jim mentioned, a lot of fishing businesses, a lot of fishermen are being forced out of the industries, in spite of the fact that there are plenty of fish out there. I want to use as an example the New England groundfish fishery. I'm sure most of you are familiar with the New England groundfish fishery as the poster child for everything bad in fisheries management. I'll use some numbers just because that makes the story a little more real. In 2010, the annual catch limit for the New England groundfish fishery was 94,000 metric tons. Of that, only 34,000 metric tons was caught. In 2008, the target TAC, total allowable catch, was 170,000 metric tons. 43,000 metric tons were caught. Those numbers, or the ratio of those numbers, would indicate that in 2010 we caught 39% of the fish we were allowed to catch. In 2008, we only caught 25%. However, when you look at the bottom line numbers, which is what the fishing industry is interested in 2008, 43,000 tons were caught. In 2010, only 37,000 tons were caught. This is because the fisheries management system at this point is driven primarily through what's called the precautionary principle. If we don't know, we assume the worst case is at work, and we ratchet down the total allowable catch, or at this point it's become the annual catch limit. And this is basically because we don't have the research capabilities to more accurately count the fish. So one of our primary problems is we don't have good assessments, and we're getting there, but we're getting there with diminishing budgets. And the less we know about fish, the less fish we're allowed to catch. Our primary focus at this point should be on better fish catching. And another primary focus, I guess you can't have two, is we need, as Jim said, we need more flexibility in the Magnuson Act. We're all soldered now with a 10-year rebuilding deadline for fish stocks. This has no basis in science. It has no basis in anything. It's just a line drawn in the sand. This means you have to read, the fisherman in the fishery has to reach an arbitrary rebuilt level, as Dr. Lubchenco said, by next year, regardless of the impact that's going to have on the fishermen, on the fishing businesses, on the fishing communities. This is where all of the gnashing of teeth and tearing of hair is coming from in New England. Fishermen are being forced out of business in spite of the fact that there are plenty of fish out there, and they're being forced out just to meet because the fishery can't meet this arbitrary deadline. In the interest of time, I'm going to have to shut it off there, but I'm going to establish a website called fishtruth.net, where I'm going to put up some the information I would have liked to have covered today, but unless the right questions get asked, I won't be able to. Thank you.
Perfect. And now we have, as our last opening speaker, George Geiger, who George is both a recreational fisherman himself, takes people out on charter boats, and just finished up three terms as a member of the South Atlantic Regional Management Fisheries Management Council, which is a title that would never make it into one of my articles. So, and also, George was nice enough, as a Florida native, got up well before dawn to drive here to be on this panel. And I was a little worried about it in terms of making him get up early, but he's a fisherman, so I thought I didn't feel that guilty. So, George, go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning. And I guess the fight begins. I'm a recovering fisheries manager. I'm 61 days into my recovery, and here I am falling off the wagon this morning. So, you know, and ironically, I agree with everything Jim said up until 1996. And I agree with portions of what Nils said. And certainly I agree with the NOAA administrator. And Steve, you know, we've all had good points up here this morning. But and I'm throwing my notes away, and I'm going to wing this thing because it's an issue. Magnuson Stevens, as authorized in 06, is the most important piece of fisheries legislation to ever come in place. And the annual catch limits that are mandated as a result of that reauthorization in 06 are absolutely necessary to make up for the 30 years of neglect that Jim addressed prior to that under the old Magnuson Stevens, which was really radically flawed, whereby we really didn't accomplish anything because people were appointed to the councils based on political interest, based on economic interest. They always took the easy way out, and we never accomplished anything. For example, in the South Atlantic, we had 14 fishery management plans up until 2006. Of those 14 plans, only three met the goals and objectives that were established in those FMPs. I would consider that an abject failure of this act. And it's an abject failure because of the process, because of the people who are on the process, and that all goes into an amalgam that creates problems. Steve talked about two solutions, data and the delay in processing data and stock assessments. I listened to the earlier panels, and one of the things I would encourage, somebody spoke about positive news. There is good news. Fish stocks are recovering, and they're recovering as a result of the reauthorized Magnuson Act of 06. And annual catch limits are the key to those recoveries. Unfortunately, as Nils alluded to, we are under a draconian timeline to do that. But if you continue to protract these overfishing issues, as they have been for the past 30 years, they put us in a box whereby we have to take severe and stern action now to preclude us from getting to a point where we may not be able to recover ever. In the South Atlantic, and these are regional issues. We have 8 regional management councils. There are regional issues around the country that are totally different. There are regional solutions to those problems, and they have to be employed regionally. You don't have one size fits all, with the exception, I believe, of annual catch limits. And it's imperative that we understand that there's good news. And the good news is, and this is what you guys should be reporting, is that fishery stocks that have been historically overfished are recovering and systematically recovering under annual catch limits that are in place, requiring both the recreational and the commercial sector to fish within an annual catch mortality and stop their fishing at a point before it exceeds that. In the past, we never had measures in place that stopped people from exceeding what we thought was the allowable catch because we fished under a maximum sustainable yield philosophy. Now we're under optimum yield, and we're trying to build stocks for long-term sustainability. Overfishing, as was stated earlier, is a losing proposition for the fish and the fishermen because long-term, nobody's going to survive in this business. So the medicine is difficult. The old, you know, show me the beef. We have to belly up and pay the price now for 30 years of non-management initiative on the part of these regional fishery management councils. To Steve, I would say there's one additional thing that needs to be done, and that's looking at the process. Because if we get a stock assessment that tells us a stock is in trouble, understand that now there's a two and a half, possibly up to 3 year delay with the councils putting in place measures that will take care of those issues that were identified in the stock assessment. And that's done because of the requirements of public process and the council process. They meet quarterly for the most part. In the Southeast, we met quarterly. And it's a difficult issue. And so if you've got a stock that's in a continuing decline, and we have a stock assessment that shows we've got that stock declining, if you don't take action then and you take it 3 years later, guess what? You're going to put management measures in place for a stock that's already been in a continuing three-year decline, and your management measures are never going to catch up. So we've got issues with the process as well. Earlier, I listened to Dr. Lubchenco talk about a question that was raised about the transparency in the process. I can tell you from a council member, and having been involved in this federal process for 30 years, that this is a transparent process. And I think they're doing a magnificent job with stock assessments with regard to the data that's available. Understand it takes 20 years to develop a 20-year data set. So if you threw any amount of money at this issue, it's not going to be resolved tomorrow. It's something that has to be tackled systematically, and I think that's being done. And they're doing the best they can, I believe, having reviewed their budgets for the last 9 years, with what they have in an effort to try and improve that data systematically. Now, I will agree with Nils that I'm a little aghast that we've taken some of that budget and diverted it to catch shares, because I'm no fan of putting or diverting the public resource and giving that public resource to anybody except the public, certainly to anybody who's going to make a profit off of it, without paying some form of royalty for the privilege of harvesting that process or that resource. So I have issues with catch shares, and of course the devil is always in the details. I served on the catch share task force. We put in place measures that the councils can employ in an effort to make sure that catch shares are an equitable process. Unfortunately, that's one that takes a lot of moral courage, and you have to go up against a fishing industry that really has been harvesting for free and taking from the resource for free for a couple of hundred years. And to try and get them now to pay royalties is something that's going to be very, very difficult to implement. So I would say that it's tough. We are in a very, very difficult time. The most unfortunate aspect of my term on the council is I got off on August 10th, and the council signed the fishery management plan in place that put annual catch limits and share in place in September, and I wish my name had been on that document. So I think they're extremely critical. I think there's a lot of people, there are a tremendous number of recreational fishermen and quite a few commercial fishermen with whom I've spoken to over the course of the last 4 or 5 years during this catch share fight that agree and understand. So the fishing public in general is not totally opposed to this concept. They understand the fact that to have sustainable fisheries, sacrifices have to be made. They have to be made now. It's a tough pill to swallow, but the benefits long-term are going to be significant.
Okay, thanks so much, George. And riffing off that, I wanted to ask a question to the rest of the panel, since George just got into the issue of catch shares, of course, and to mention it as well. I'd like to get a few different perspectives on this. This is clearly one of the most controversial developments we've had in policy, initially, started by the Bush administration and then continued by the Obama administration. And I think there are just kind of a couple issues that George touched on and broadened out. So first of all, clearly it's come under attack from certain members of the fishing community, particularly in New England, where it's been more embraced, and say on the West Coast and in Alaska. And what's interesting is, of course, that some of them criticize it for taking away their rights. I think a lot of other people would say it's very interesting. We're seeing this emerging debate of to what extent should we privatize the ocean, both in terms of fisheries and other parts of marine management. And I am very interested. We do tons of subsidies for American farmers, but we don't give them farmland for free. And we certainly make our oil companies pay for the extractive activities they take. So I'm interested in getting the perspective of why people think that might be a way to go or is not a way to go. And again, would there be any political possibility of, for example, making people, George, you already talked and you talked over your length. Everyone else kept their length, so you're going to go last. And so you still will get to chime in. But give me perspectives on what you think. No, but you were good. I'm just saying I'm going to be a hard ass. Okay, who wants to take this? Well, actually, so Steve raised his hand first. So we'll go to Steve, then Jim, and then go ahead.
Okay, let me just set the stage on this by saying I think there are a lot of social issues in terms of questions of who gets allocated shares and things like that. But before we get into those issues, let me just put this in the context of what's the record of performance of cat shares around the world, because this experiment has been tried hundreds of times in fisheries around the world. And we did an analysis 3 years ago looking at, on the order of 11,000 global fisheries and their performance, their likelihood of collapse, and a variety of other things along these lines. And the best performing management practice within the broad array of experiments that have been tried in all of these thousands of fisheries around the world was cat shares in terms of reducing the likelihood of overfishing and fisheries going into collapse. So from the standpoint of the both economic and ecological performance of the fishery, cat shares were really successful. That's a very different situation from asking this question about whether individuals should pay, how you allocate the rights in the cat share, and things along those lines. But in terms of the context, they perform extremely well in terms of reducing the likelihood of overfishing.
Okay, excellent observation, Jim, and then Nils, and then George, and then I'm going to put Jane on the hot seat, but go first. Okay.
Yeah, I want to respond to, first of all, the basic framework for Magnuson does work. And what we have to fix within Magnuson are certain areas. For instance, we know that there's stocks of fish right now that are healthy. Black sea bass in the mid-Atlantic is 125% over their sustainable biomass. They're healthy. Yet the fishery is shut down right now, completely shut down. It's shut down because of provisions within Magnuson. For instance, you can look at stocks of fish. There's a line here of stocks of fish. Up here is healthy, up here and down here is healthy, but we have to meet a certain line because of the arbitrary nature of some of the provisions in the law. And because of that arbitrary nature, we have boats tied to the dock in a healthy fishery. Red snapper is another one. Red snapper, we are tripping over red snapper in Florida, yet it's a very restrictive fishery. Why? Lack of good science. Now that's not anyone's fault. We've got to get better science out here. To go to cat shares is not the answer. And the word,
why not?
Because
what specifically? What's flawed about cat shares?
Well, first of all, it's a violation in our belief of the public trust doctrine. These are public resources. They belong to the public. You and everyone else in this room has a right to access those fisheries. And to privatize them, to put them up for sale like stock shares on Wall Street. And I know there's a lot of young people in here that probably agree with, the protest that's going on about the corporate greed. Imagine putting our fisheries up for corporate greed and big-time bankers. That's what's going to happen with cat shares.
Do you make a distinction between, obviously you're talking about a public resource, between someone like you who might go out, do recreational fishing, keep it for yourself, and someone who's actually got a business that's based on it? Is there any distinction between those two groups?
Well, the party charter boat industry, all they are, the people that drive charter boats or party boats, all they are is bus drivers. They take regular people out fishing. So they're more commerce than anyone else.
Okay.
Including myself. When I go fishing myself recreationally, there's lots of commerce there being connected. I buy a boat, I fuel it, I maintain it, I go to the deli, I buy sandwiches. There's a lot of money being spent. There's a lot of expenditures there. So it's all commerce. The commercial industry and the recreational industry are both commerce. Lots of commerce, multi-billion dollar industries. Traditional open access is what we support. And I agree with Dr. Gaines that cat shares do work in certain fisheries. The problem is that NOAA is telling commercial fishermen, you have to do this. And commercial fishermen should decide where a cat share works. For instance, in that crab fishery up in Alaska, that's where it works, in other fisheries. But don't have the government tell you how you should fish. And that's the problem we have with cat shares. Pardon?
Sorry. Should we define why doesn't Daniel define it, and then
cat share? By the way, sharing is not what cat share is about. It's about not sharing.
We're not sharing.
Very good point.
It consists of it's a bit nerdic, but let's say five elements. The first is that there should be a quota, a total allowable catch, because if you don't have that, the fishery is going down the tube. So there is a quota that is set every year. The second is that the quota is individualized. Individual people take a certain fraction of that quota. That's a privatization we're talking about. And only those individual people. Because if you don't have that, the quota is caught by all fishers in a competition. And they build an immense effort, an immense fleet, to catch as much as possible so the other guys don't get it before the 10,000 tons, say, of the quota are caught. And that leads to derby fishery, to fisheries that are completed in one day, that catch, that has happened, that catch everything and land fish within 2 days. This leads to low-value fish, to overcapacity, to too many boats, to accident, to low price for fish, and so on. So these first two elements, having a quota and individualizing the quota, are very positive, and there are very few people who are against it. Some people are here, some of these are here, but actually most people are in favor of this. However, three additional things are being tagged onto this idea of individualized quota. The notion that they should be given away. There is no real reason why they should be given away. They can be sold, they can be auctioned, they can be rented, and so on. The second, that they should be given away in perpetuity. That's an absurdity. Nothing is forever. Quota cut shares should need not to be. And third, and that's the more deadly thing, they should be transferable. And the transferability of quota would make them a commodity like anything else, like pork bellies. And contrary to what you say here, the experience of transferability has been very negative, because people, they cannot be kept in the hands of the fishers. They move to the capital, move to banks, and are speculated with the same way as you, as people have speculated with subprimes. And a country that had attitude, this is the real name of Katshe, individual transferable quota, has seen is the quota for the fishing of its major stock, Iceland, move from the province where the fishers are to the capital, and then move to the U.S. where they were bought by some giant bank that went under in 2008, and the Icelandic parliament had to ask to intervene, to ask, where are our catch share? Who is the right to catch our fish? Iceland didn't know anymore who the catch share was. And in BC, for example, where I live, British Columbia, 80% of the fishers are employees of firms that own the shares. They have been totally taken out of the fishing sector. They are now in the hand of the banking sector. So remember, catch shares. They have two elements that are reasonable, and three that we have from Milton Friedman and the Chicago gang that have nothing to do with anything.
Okay, Milton Friedman isn't here to defend himself, but he can stand it. We're going to have Nils, then Jane, and then we'll go to George. Then. So Nils, go ahead.
All right, first off, I'm not opposed to or in favor of catch shares, because I'm not a fisherman. I don't know any pieces of fishing boats. I don't want to. Catch shares do work in some fisheries. Some fisheries work where they don't have catch shares. I'm most familiar with the Mid-Atlantic Fisheries Management Council, which goes from North Carolina to New York State. They manage, I think, 12 fisheries. Two of those fisheries are managed by catch shares. The other 10 aren't. All of those fisheries are doing well. I think that none of those fisheries at this point are being overfished, are considered overfished, and I don't think in any of those fisheries overfishing has taken place. The difference between those two classifications is subtle and not really that important for this discussion, I don't think. But the important thing in all of those fisheries is they're managed by a TAC, total allowable catch, or annual catch limit, as they're now called. the fishermen in those fisheries can't exceed that level of fishing. This is the commercial fishermen. And the system works without having transferable quotas or anything like that. In the summer flounder fishery, which is managed fairly successfully, except that there's a lot more fish out there, and the tack, the quotas, aren't high enough, it's taken 10, 12, 15 years to get the right balance between small boats, big boats, inshore fisheries, offshore fisheries. It's managed, the individual quotas, not the individual, I shouldn't say that, the quota is managed on a state-by-state basis. I'm most familiar with the New Jersey system, and they have four seasons designed so the little boat guys get their fair share, something approaching their historical share, and the big boat guys get something approaching their historical share. And this is done without transferability. This is being done without concentration of fishing power. One of the biggest causes of concern in the fishing industry in New England with the groundfish catchers program is concentration. The little guys, the little boats, the inshore fishery is being forced out of business.
Okay, Mills, pretty soon I'm going to kick it over to Jane. Is there anything else you wanted to say specifically on cat shares? Okay, fantastic. Jane, can you?
Yep, so I want to make six quick points that address some of the issues that are here. Some of these are corrections and some of these are clarifications. The first one is there is, I think, maybe some confusion among all of you with a lot of this terminology. And we've talked about both catch limits and catch shares, and I want to make sure we're all on the same page with respect to what that means. Catch limits, everybody agrees, is a good idea. There's a cap on the total number of fish that can be caught. That's very different from the fishery management tool that is used to regulate the fishery. And catch shares are a type of fishery management. Okay? So just to make sure that that's clear. Secondly, the traditional fishery management versus catch shares. Let me just describe that very briefly, a little more simply than Danielle did. Traditional fisheries is often called a race for fish, and this is with respect to commercial fisheries is what we're really talking about when we're talking about catch shares. Race for fish, the gun goes off at the beginning of the season, everybody goes out to get as much as they can, as fast as they can. Hence, the more and bigger boats, faster and faster, more and more gear, so that you can beat everybody else who's competing for that same resource. And in some fisheries, it really has been reduced to a single day. The whole entire fishing quota for the year is caught in a single day because of this intense race for fish. Catch shares is a different management tool in contrast to traditional management, race for fish, in which the based on past fishing history, commercial fishermen are allocated a certain fraction of the catch. This is not a right, it's a privilege. It's not privatizing the ocean. It is allocating rights to fish based on past history. And the concept is actually very simple. And one of the economists who has worked on this has provided the analogy that I'm going to give you that I think explains it pretty simply. If you have two kids and they're both interested in having a Slurpee, you can give each of them their own Slurpee, or you can have them share one big one. If you have them share one big one, what's going to happen? They're both going to drink as fast as they can to beat out the other guy, get more, and probably get brain freeze. Bad consequences happen, okay? If, in fact, you have some way of saying, okay, you're each going to have the same size and you each have half of it, then they can drink the Slurpee at their own pace and have enjoy it, not compete. So that's sort of the basic analogy. Catch shares are a management tool that is proven. It has, based on the analyses that Steve was describing, across developing countries, tropics, temperate areas, it has a proven track record. But not all catch share systems are the same. The fourth major point that I want to make is that NOAA has a catch share policy. This policy does not require anybody to use a catch share for any fishery. There is no imposition of catch shares on anyone. U.S. fisheries are managed by the fishery management councils that George described, eight councils. Those councils make decisions about the management that's appropriate for any particular fishery. NOAA is encouraging councils to consider catch shares. That's what councils are doing. The councils are deciding. The councils have fishermen and others on them. So there is no requirement that anybody use catch shares. We've been promoting them and providing information about them so that the councils can make good decisions and use them or not. And many councils have chosen to use them. Many councils have chosen not to use them. So they are not imposed on anyone. Five, design matters. Not all catch share systems are the same. And this is one of the challenges of catch shares. We are learning from experience within the U.S. and based on what's happening elsewhere about what kind of design works and the problem that Daniel identified of consolidation, of the big guys buying out the little guys, is a very real concern, and we've seen that in some catch share systems. You can design a catch share program to make that not be possible. You can say no one can own more than some fraction of the total quota. And so the design is important. And as we have new catch share systems coming online, we are finding that each one is so complicated that oftentimes you don't get it right from the get-go. And in New England, for example, with the groundfish fishery, this potential for consolidation was not included in the original design. And so NOAA went to the council and said, hey, we think there's a problem here. You know, we know that there are a lot of elements of the program, but you're going to have to fix this one because it actually is likely to be a problem. The council is now working on that fix, trying to figure out what they think the right balance is.
Okay, and point number six?
So, point number six, thanks, Juliet. Point number six is that many of the commercial fishermen that have experienced catch shares are saying, I can finally see the light at the end of the tunnel. It's a long tunnel, but we're getting there. I have hope for the future. Many of the recreational fishermen are saying, hey, we don't like this catch share thing. This is bad. And in fact, I think recreational fishermen need to think about three things. One, catch shares work. They end overfishing. And if that happens in the commercial fishery, that means there are more fish in the ocean. There are more fish for everyone to catch, whether it's commercial or recreational fishermen. Two, many commercial fisheries without catch shares have a huge amount of accidental catch, bycatch. Catch shares provide incentive for commercial fishermen to fish more cleanly. There's less environmental impact, and therefore, that has less of a negative impact for the commercial fisheries, recreational fishermen.
And with that, I want to turn
and
to
three, it provides an opportunity.
Three points within point six.
There provides an opportunity for allocation across sectors because one of the themes that isn't really emerging here is the tension between recreational and commercial fishermen, and the allocation issues are a challenge. And catch shares provide a potential mechanism for this reallocation.
Okay. Now, I'm turning over to George. I also want to pose a question, which I'm actually going to pose to you, even though it's in response to what we just heard, which is, how is it not privatizing a public resource when you're not only giving fishermen a catch, but then allowing them to treat it as a commodity, that they, in fact, can sell it? How is that not privatizing a resource? Can you both speak a little bit to that, if you can? Or if not, just make your point, if you want to.
Well, let me make my point first.
Okay, go ahead.
So I can focus on your question.
Go ahead.
But in regard to Dr. Dutchenko's comments, I agree. And this is a regional issue. Understand, around the country there are industrialized fisheries, and in the southeast we have artisanal fisheries. We don't have any large boats that go out and harvest a billion and a half pounds of fish as they do in the pollock fishery. But one of the issues that I do take issue with is that we don't really understand the economic value of our fisheries. In the southeast, we have a tremendous recreational fishery, and it's argued that the recreational fishery is the southeast, the South Atlantic. And there's an economic value to those fish. And once you give those fish away in a catch share, nowhere in the world has anybody ever done away with the catch share or given them back. So if it's at some time down the line, we determine that the true economic value of these fish for the benefit of the nation lies with a recreational fishery, we never get them back. You're always going to have this artisanal commercial fishery of some sort, you know, catching fish that are fundamentally and extremely more valuable to the recreational sector and to the nation.
So George, that's the reallocation. The catchers actually, you can buy them from the commercial guys if it's set up to be that. So it actually allows you to solve that problem.
But one of the issues, and Danielle hit on them, all the three things that he identified, if you put those in a catch share plan, that plan will be soundly rejected by the commercial industry. For each one of those in the southeast, they will, because we've done that. Now, in a pure commercial fishery where you don't have a mixed fishery of commercial and recreation, I think catch shares are the way to go. You know, certainly the South Atlantic is doing one on golden crab for seven boats. But the importance of that is to ensure that we don't have an expansion in that fishery and those boats don't impact deep water corals, which occur right here off the Miami Terrace. So we're trying to protect deep sea corals, and there's a benefit to that.
Okay, that's very helpful. Let's open it up for questions. I'm sure there are folks with questions at this point. I see a young woman going to the microphone right now. Go for it. You're first up.
Hi, I'm Sarah. I am with Fish Navy Films, and I'm curious. We talked a lot about our wild fisheries, and while they may be recovering some stocks, and we have new management options, I think everyone would agree that we couldn't feed the country just on wild fisheries. And so Dr. Pauly spoke a little bit about aquaculture and sustainable aquaculture, but we don't have a lot of sustainable aquaculture domestically, and I was wondering if you guys could speak to that and speak to how that might be happening in the future.
Sure. Who wants to?
Aquaculture is actually a Chinese enterprise. If you look at the aquaculture, people talk about 40 million tons and 40% of the fish that we eat are from aquaculture and stuff. This is all propaganda, because actually there's no we there. More than two-thirds of aquaculture production is in China. And the rest of the world does one-third. When you average between something very big and something very small, you don't get any reasonable thing. Average the income of Bill Gates and Daniel Pauly, you don't get some sort of... You get another multi-billionaire. You don't get some average. And the average that we do for the world of aquaculture is really not right. Because in China, they eat carp and they eat bivalves in enormous quantities. In the West, when we talk about aquaculture, it's not carp, it's not bivalve, it is salmon. And salmon and other carnivores. And these cannot be produced such that they meet a demand other than luxury demand, luxury consumption. I'm concerned about food security, and food security will not be solved by aquaculture as we conceive in the West. And since I have the floor, one word. I like the Slurpee story. That was neat. But we have six children, not four, not two. And we have only two Slurpees. And we are not on contraceptive. So we're going to have lots of children. and only two Slurpees. They are shared, but you can see the problem. The other kids are not getting any Slurpee.
Who knew that birth control and 7-Eleven would come up in a fisheries panel? Now, I want to let Jim...
I just want to say one quick word. SCJ rules, SCJ member journalists ask the questions first, and if we have extra time, then the others will
okay,
go as well.
Very, very good point. All right, Jim just wants to chime in. I didn't give him a chance to talk, and then we're going to go to you, assuming that you're a journalist, but... so go ahead.
Thank you. I just want to respond to Dr. Luchenko respectfully. If I didn't know what I knew about the political process here of how this all went down, I would say, Dr. Luchenko, you just sold me. But let me tell you what went on here. Since the Obama administration came in, the catch share issue really became a highlight. And the way this works, the way this council process works, each governor under Magnuson gets to send down three names from the commercial sector, three names from the recreational sector to NOAA to appoint to the council. And generally, the way it's been from president to president, whether it was Bill Clinton, didn't matter. When there was an incumbent that was serving on the council, and this incumbent made all the meetings and did everything according to the book, this incumbent would always stay as the person of choice because that governor wanted it to be. Or if a governor wanted someone very badly as a number one choice, the feds would always traditionally respect that choice, and then the administration would put that person in. But since the Obama administration, what's happened is we've lost incumbents, and we've had people put in place, and of course, NOAA got a clear message from Congress that there will be no catch shares. There was a bill. It was Walter Jones and a bunch of other bipartisan members, Barney Frank, was no catch shares.
But it didn't pass, did it?
Oh, yes, it did. The resolution passed.
It's not legislation. It was a rider on the continuing resolution.
That's right. It was
that prohibited us from starting any new catch shares.
But it was the will of Congress. It was the will of Congress, which is the will of people. And, of course, the administration said, we don't care about personal freedom. We don't care about honoring the separation of powers. And they just threw it out and said, no, we're going to move forward and we're going to put people on this council until we can get the agenda we want through. And that's how we see it. It's a huge political issue. It's not as simple as drinking out of one Slurpee cup.
Okay, and we're going to go to the next one. Just a clarification, if people are, what Jim was referring to was the appropriations rider that was enacted as part of the April budget deal, which actually it was in place through the end of the fiscal year, which is now over. But that was adopted as part of that law. Yes, and
hi.
Please identify yourself.
Jeff Young with the public radio program Living on Earth. I want to return to the issue of consolidation or concentration under catch shares and how that can be avoided. I remember talking to a fisherman in Gloucester, and he really boiled down the anxiety, I think, that a lot of small fishermen feel. He said, they're going to get rid of a lot of little guys like me who are just making a living so that a few big guys can make a killing. And that's, I think, the underlying anxiety. And you know, in addition, they're worried about the effect on the larger community because the larger guys are so vertically integrated, they're not going to rely on the ice house, the net menders, the, you know, engine boat repair guys in the community because they have their own. And so they're the spillover effects on the host communities. So what are the key ways that you have a catch share that achieves the conservation goals, you know, without tilting the system to favor the big guys?
Okay. Jeff, that's one of the reasons that I emphasized how important the design of the catch share program is. And it varies from one to another. And one of the things that we are doing at NOAA is providing councils with the kinds of things they need to think about in designing a catch share program. In New England, as elsewhere, the potential for consolidation is very real. Now, I personally feel that we should be having diverse fishing fleets, small boats, medium boats, large boats, for example, in New England. It's not just about the economic getting the most fish in the shortest amount of time. It's about a cultural heritage, especially in a place like New England, but elsewhere as well. And because that program did not include limits on consolidation, we went to the council and said, oh, by the way, you didn't do this, and we really think you should reconsider. And so council is taking that up. you can design a catch share program to prevent consolidation. And that, I think, is a highly desirable thing to do. We will continue at NOAA to be responsive to what the councils are proposing, because they put the plans together and then they bring them to us.
Okay, and thank you for that observation. We're going to move on to Steve, if that's okay. And then over to Nels. Go ahead.
Just real briefly, you know, it strikes me that we've had a couple of phases here in the development of some of these reforms. And in the initial adoption of CatShares, it's really been thinking about how you align economic and ecological goals. And early in the process, I think a lot of these social goals were not part of the discussion. And I think consolidation is just one of many potential social changes that can happen when you change the business model that you're actually operating fisheries under. And so I think the key part here, expanding what Jane said, is to have a discussion up front of what the social goals are. If the social goal is to maintain a certain type of structure of the fleet, whether it's small and large mix, to maintain a spread of the fleet geographically so that you don't have consolidation happen in one port and other ports going out of business, these are all things that can be done in terms of the upfront design, as long as there's a discussion upfront about what those social goals are. So we really need to be thinking about how we put ecological, economic, and social goals on the table up front, and then design the system to maximize the ability to achieve those three simultaneously.
Fantastic. Over to Nels. And then next question.
One of the potential problems I see with catch shares is it's fairly easy to control who owns the catch share, or whatever the term is, you know, whatever you do with catch shares, to have a bunch of catch shares. The problem is not who owns them, but who controls them. And that isn't necessarily who's holding the shares. That's who he or she is financed by, who he or she buys ice by, gets his onshore provisioning, that kind of thing. And that's something that's much more difficult to control. That's something that's much more difficult even to find out. And this is one of the concerns. Not who's holding the shares, but who's controlling him or her. Who's telling them what to do with their shares, how to fish them, how to sell them, or whatever. And I don't see any practical way of controlling that.
Great. Dave.
Yes, David Helvary, author. And let me just throw another small grenade in the pond, which is George W. Bush created the largest no-take marine wilderness area in the history of the United States. And it's a movement around the world to create these marine protected areas that are supposed to be primarily for marine wildlife and habitat, but the advocates say they're also good for commercial fisheries, and then there are a lot of people who say they're destroying commercial and recreational fisheries. So I suspect you have a diversity of opinion on MPAs as well.
And obviously, and we'll let George lead off on this, and maybe we could also, if someone wants to speak to how there are obviously marine protected areas that are being created here in the United States, primarily off the coast of California, as well as in some areas, including Massachusetts. Let's start with George on that.
Thank you for your question. Ironically, I serve on the Federal Advisory Committee on Marine Protected Areas as well. And during my tenure on the South Atlantic Council, the 9 years that I was on the council, we worked on a marine protected area concept for the southeast from North Carolina to Key West. And we created 9 deep water marine protected areas. And that process took 20 years. You know, that was a 20-year process to get those 9 small protected areas in place. And they were put in place in an effort to, number one, protect habitat and spawning aggregations and habitat for juvenile fish that were critically overfished, deep water grouper species specifically. So the marine protected area, I forget their formal name, I'm drawing a blank, but there's a formal committee, the Marine Protected Area Committee, is responsible now for cataloging around the United States all the extant marine protected areas that were either originated by states, tribal, or the federal government, and consolidating that list. And they're now beginning an effort to look to see if there are gaps, doing a gap-filling exercise in an effort to see if gaps exist and what may need to be done in the future. So I don't know if that helps an age your question or not.
Okay, Nels, and then we'll...
The commercial fishery has supported marine protected areas for, I don't know, 30, 40 years, however long they've come into play. But these are areas in which fishing restrictions are imposed for particular reasons. As far as I know, and I have problems speaking for the commercial fishing industry, obviously, but as far as I know, when it comes to arbitrarily setting up 10%, 12%, 5%, whatever the ocean is marine protected areas, the commercial fishermen I'm familiar with have problems with that. The most obvious one is you set up marine protected areas where the fish are, which means that you've got a lot of open areas where the fish aren't. Needless to say, that's problematic to a lot of fishermen. But other than that, you know, if it's a particular area which is important seasonally or important permanently to keep fishing out, commercial fishing industry has gone along with that and will continue to go along with that. It's just arbitrarily saying we need X percentage of the ocean bottom.
I know Jim wants to chime in, but is there anyone on the scientific side who wants to just speak a little bit to what we found out in terms of science on MPA, since obviously there's been a lot on that? Go ahead.
Oh, let me do that.
Then we'll go back to. Unless Jim, do you want to just make your? Well, why don't you just make your point, and then we'll end with Steve and go to the next question.
I think there's a misperception about MPAs, marine protected areas, and marine reserves. Our organization, RFA, we're completely against any arbitrary marine reserve, just closing parts of the ocean down to no access for anyone.
How do you define arbitrary, meaning like you're just against closing it? Under any circumstances?
Yeah, for instance, just close an area down. What's the reason? Give us some scientific reasons for closing it down to no access. However, MPAs are a tool that we support. For instance, that could be a time and area closure on a spawning ground. You don't want to be targeting a certain species when they're vulnerable. Mm-hmm. There's time and area closures in the Straits of Florida for swordfish, things like that. There's tools that we believe in, but that marine reserve that you referred to, that the President Bush put in, we were completely opposed to that. That was arbitrary in nature. That had no basis in science to keep everybody off the water. We could not understand that, and that's what we're opposed to. That flies against our mission statement.
Okay, and so by the way, just to follow up, so the fact that the Bush administration said, look, here are the ecological values of this place, you know, these are the sharks, these are the seabirds, everything like that, that was not compelling scientific evidence to you?
No, not at all.
Okay. Steve, do you want to go? And then let's go to the next question.
Sure. Just quickly, let me put this in context. If, you know, we have set aside areas on land as protected areas where there are a variety of actions that are restricted, including hunting and fishing and things along these lines. And if you look at the amount of land that's protected, it's somewhere on the order of 15% of what people have done in terms of setting it around. The current level of protection in terms of comparable of any form of protection, permanent protection in the ocean, is less than 1%. And in areas where there's no fishing allowed at all, it's less than about 0.1%. So we're still talking about minute fractions of the ocean that have been set aside in terms of trying to achieve some goals from protection. I think the evidence from these has been very clear in the sense that they can be, and just as in the catch shares, if you articulate a range of goals up front, and so if the goal is purely to protect a special place that has particular areas, and you're not thinking about the impacts on fishing, that you can have deleterious effects. But they can also be designed in ways that they're actually providing benefits to outside, either because they harbor and allow fish to grow much older and larger, and then they occasionally swim over and create spectacular fishing areas on the edges, or they can be a sort of a broodstock area where you're protecting old females that then produce young that are drifting on ocean currents and can be supporting areas outside. Both of these have been demonstrated scientifically to have beneficial effects to fisheries outside, but a key part of it, again, is to be thinking about what are your goals, and if you're trying to integrate in protected areas as one of the pieces of the tool chest, they can be a very successful mechanism of enhancing both recreational and commercial fishing success.
Okay. You get 30 seconds like a Republican presidential candidate.
That's right.
Go.
Thank you. Using percentages is a little tricky, so just remember that Most of the water contains no fish most of the time. You got a big ocean, right? Where those percentages are is where everybody fishes. So that percentage is very high. It's not the entire ocean. You can't look at it using percentage numbers. It's a very tricky way of saying marine reserves are only getting a small percentage of the ocean. It's a big percentage of the usable ocean where we fish. So keep that in mind.
Done. On to the next question.
Thank you. I'm Susan Jewell, author and freelance writer. The focus of this session seems to be on ocean fisheries, but there's another major fishery in the United States, which is a commercial fishery, which is the Great Lakes fishery. Mm-hmm. And from what I understand, the Great Lakes stocks are being depleted. They're crashing. Fishermen's boats are not going out because it's not worth it. And one of the causes seems to be invasive species such as zebra mussels and sea lampreys. So I was wondering if the fishermen can address if the situation in the Great Lakes is the same. Do you have the same optimism? And would your recommendations be the same for the Great Lakes fisheries?
Okay, you're right that this panel does have an ocean bias. Is there anyone who can speak to the Great Lakes fishery?
No.
Okay.
They do have.
So we don't regulate. They're not federally regulated, which is why we're not talking about them.
Okay.
But they do have a commission.
Right. There certainly is. I mean, there's no question the Obama administration has created a commission.
No, not the Obama. It's been in existence since they created the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. There's been a Great Lakes.
Okay, because there's a federal Great Lakes Task Force, which has been created particularly to deal with things like invasive species. But okay. So I'm really sorry that we can't answer that. Let's try to get to the next one.
Hi. My name is Ann Parson. I'm a book author who hails from the fishing grounds of New Bedford. And for a long time, I believe counting fish has been really an inexact science. One question is, is there still lots of disagreement over fish counts? I believe there is. And in New Bedford, I wanted to share a story. There's a great success story there involving a scientist by the name of Kevin Stokesbury. He's from UMass Dartmouth, who has been using video surveys of scallops on the seafloor. And it's led to a very efficient management that fishermen agree with, ways of counting, actually following the populations of scallops. So my question really also is, what do you see as specific tools that are going to help improve fish counts in the future? Thank you.
Okay, so we have. Why don't we have Nils and George, and then I'd love to get one of either, you know, the scientists to chime in on that as well.
Right. I'll use it as an example, the monkfish fishery, which is the most valuable edible finfish fishery on the East Coast. 12, 13 years ago, the monkfish fishery was on the verge of being closed. The only census they were taken of monkfish was the New England bottom trawl surveys, where they used a net which was designed to catch bottom-hugging round fish, codfish, haddock, like that. The scientists weren't catching monkfish. The fishermen said, there's plenty of monkfish out there. And of course, the manager said, you're wrong. You know, you always say that. The industry managed to get some Woods Hole scientists out on a couple of commercial fishing boats. And lo and behold, the commercial fishing boats, and these were run by professional monkfish fishermen, caught the monkfish that the NIMP survey vessel was saying weren't there. The assessment people took this to heart. We expanded the survey. We've been doing it every 3 years for the last 4 years, and this has kept the fishery alive. This has kept the fishery going. It's basically a matter of doing cooperative research, which tends to be a little bit expensive, tends to be a little cumbersome administratively. But fishermen, every once in a while, are better at catching fish than scientists are. And I think I've been involved in a number of cooperative research programs since then, and not once that I know of has the industry come out as a loser in a cooperative research program. It generates better information. It adds to the information that the scientists are gathering on their own. And it's something that we should be doing as much of as is possible.
Fantastic. Let's go to George, and then I want to have this. I want to have the scientists chime in.
Thank you. And in the Southeast, one of the things that we're doing, Jim mentioned red snapper and the abundance of red snapper earlier. In an effort to try and get a better handle on that particular biomass, MARMAP, which is a program run by South Carolina, a federally funded program that samples benthic species from North Carolina to Key West, has redesigned that program in an effort to try and better understand the red snapper population. In addition to that, they've installed video monitoring on their traps. It's a trapping program, so they're installing video monitors on the trap, which also will help with the identification of abundance in and around the areas that they're fishing. The Science Center in Miami here has conducted a cooperative long line research program with the commercial fishery in an effort to identify a population of larger fish that were believed to be extant outside or be in closer to the Gulf Stream. The state of Florida has initiated a state tagging program whereby they've done cooperative research cruises with commercial fishermen and tagged large quantities of red snapper. And I guess that's it. I had one other note here, but
okay.
I'll leave it at that.
And Daniel wants to chime in?
Monkfish.
And then Jay.
Monkfish illustrate very well this thing that I was talking about expanding into species groups that were never fished. Essentially, monkfish is a mouth attached to a tail, right? They are extremely ugly, and you have to cut off the head before you can market them. They are one example of many of fish that are now targeted that were before never targeted. And if a catch is maintained by targeting new species, that means you don't have sustainability overall, because the other species that were contributing to that catch are not there anymore, and you are going into new species. And even in the U.S. now, there is a tendency to see jellyfish as a potential and as an actual fisheries. And people will tell you that thousands of pounds of jellyfish are being found, are being landed. It's a good thing. But imagine what it is. It's actually bad things, because it means that's all we fish now. This is what we are reduced to doing now, which is to fish jellyfish. This is not a good thing that we fish monkfish. These are resource of last resort.
Now, Jane will give a 17-point answer on fish counting, which she's prepared on her iPad. So go ahead. But then we only have one more question, so you're going to be last person. Go ahead.
So everybody agrees that we need good information to decide how many fish we can catch. But doing that is not an easy thing. A famous fish biologist once said that counting fish is the same as counting trees, except that they're in the dark and they move. And to that I would add, they're also not uniformly distributed. They're really highly patchy. And so there is a whole science of doing fishery stock assessments that has evolved through time, not only in the U.S. but elsewhere, to really figure out how to get a good handle on what's out there. And it's not an easy thing to do. We at NOAA invest a huge amount of our resources every year in doing stock assessments so we can be making good decisions. The problem, though, is that there are so many more fish out there than we are adequately sampling. We simply do not have the resources to do stock assessments for every single fishery and every single year, which is what fishermen would like. And so if there's a lot of year-to-year variability, what's there this year may in fact be different from what was there last year, but we have to use the most recent available information to be making our decisions. So how do we get around this problem? I think Dr. Gaines has alluded to some of the new ideas that are coming forth about how do we make better use of existing information to get us out of this Red Queen problem, this dilemma, where we are running faster and faster, doing more and more stock assessments, but getting farther and farther behind because There are more and more out there to be assessed, and everybody wants stock assessments every year instead of every 2 years or every 5 years or whatever. So that's the dilemma that we're in. New kinds of analyses, new technologies like the one with scallops are the kinds of things that we're looking at. We are open to any ideas. And some of those best creative ideas have been coming from fishermen and from cooperative programs with fishermen to try to figure out how to do better assessments, how to use technologies, how to work together to get the information that we all believe is important. So this is an evolving art. We actually do a pretty good job of some of it, but it's never enough. New creativity, new innovation is exactly what we've been embracing.
Fabulous. Now, our last question.
Cassandra Brooks with the Last Ocean Project. This is questions mostly for Jane and Daniel. I keep hearing we can't achieve sustainable fisheries until we get rid of fisheries subsidies, so I was hoping you could talk about, is that true? And sorry you only have 2 minutes to talk about it, but and what's being done about it?
So fishery subsidies are a real issue. They're a huge problem many places, in many countries around the world. This is an area that Daniel has studied, so I'll let him tell you sort of his perspectives on this. But I would suggest that this is an issue that we believe needs to be tackled globally. There are some challenges in doing so, and we have been working very avidly through the WTO, the World Trade Organization, to reduce subsidies and hopefully eliminate the perverse subsidies that are globally driving a lot of the very significant overfishing. We're working hard on that. We're devoted to that. It's not an easy thing to do. And it's very political. If we think politics are a challenge in the U.S. at the international scale, they're even more. However, even with countries that subsidize a lot of fisheries, there is agreement on the need to do away with illegal, unreported, and unregulated fisheries, which we also haven't talked about. And that is a huge problem in addition to the subsidies. I just want to make sure that we're flagging that for everybody. The U.S. and the EU have recently signed an agreement to address IUU fishing, pirate fishing, so-called, and it is understood to be somewhere on the order of $10 to $30 billion a year business. As much as 40% of some fisheries might be this pirate fishing. Eliminating it is important. So global problems, big.
We're going to allow Daniel 15 to 30 seconds to answer. These three guys get 15 to 30 seconds, and then we're done.
So the WTO has indeed. The World Trade Organization in the last years devoted an enormous amount of attention to fishery subsidy. Before they were not on an agenda of the WTO, they are now. The U.S. has played a very positive role. The people who bash the U.S. in this case were totally surprised because the U.S. Played a very positive role, but the subsidy negotiation didn't work, not because of the fishery, but because of agricultural subsidy, where the U.S. doesn't play such a positive role. And so the Doha round of negotiation collapsed. And it's a pity because probably subsidies are the Achilles heel of the commercial fisheries, of these crazy fisheries, because they are afloat only because of subsidies, many fisheries in the world.
Okay. Down the line, we'll start with George, Nils, Jim.
Getting back to the original premise of the discussion up here, I would like everybody to focus on the fact that there's good news. We are ending overfishing, which is critical, to end overfishing. We're doing that by virtue of the current Magnuson-Stevens reauthorization, which needs to remain in place. Annual catch limits work. We have fisheries that have recovered and are scheduled recovering. And that's good news, folks, and we need to get that out to the general public. Support Magnuson, keep it in place. Thank you.
Okay, two sentences. What do you got?
Getting back to subsidies, as far as I know, there aren't any significant subsidies for U.S. commercial fishing industry.
One sentence, even better. Jim.
Regarding the lack of money for stock assessments, and this is no reflection on Dr. Lubchenco, her administration, this goes back, I've been working the Hill for 16 years. Our federal government, between the State Department and whoever, and NOAA, spends millions and millions of dollars in other countries to develop their fisheries. That money should be spent here on science so we can keep our American fishing fleet going.
Okay, and then Jane gets one last word, and then we're...
So we are ending overfishing. We've rebuilt 21 stocks since the year 2000. There is progress being made, but I can't underscore enough how challenging it is for all fishermen right now in this economic time. And as we keep our eye on the future, we need to figure out how to get there together. And that's really what we are devoted to. What we're seeing play out with a number of catch share programs is actually relieving fishermen of unduly burdensome regulations. And that's what's happening in New England with the sector program there, where, in fact, fishermen are free to be entrepreneurial small businessmen to do what they do well. And that's beginning to happen in New England, and we've seen it happen with other catch share programs, where they can actually make business decisions that work for them and in the process recover fisheries. That's what we're trying to do. That's what we will keep trying to do.
Excellent. And I just want to say, as a born and bred Washingtonian, a town that has lost the ability to debate issues in a civil way, I want us to thank all our panelists for really having a spirited discussion at a high level. Great.
And Juliette Alperin from the Washington Post, thank you very, very much. Thank you. Demon Fish is her book, now on Amazon.com. Very briefly, gentlemen, just real quickly before you stand up, let me just say a couple of really important things, and so please listen up. Coffee. Every journalist, that's an important topic. Remember, we have coffee spread out in the exhibit area, three different spots, so please find those coffee breaks and coffee spots and thank our vendors for being out there. The Cousteau film, the world premiere, the American premiere that you've heard about tonight. Some of you did not get our RSVP confirmed. We want you to know there will be likely attrition on that list of confirmed, so if you don't believe you're confirmed, show up anyway. We're going to try to find a way to get you on there in the worst-case scenario, it's in the heart of South Beach and Lincoln Road. There's plenty to do if you don't get a chance to get into the Film Fest, but we do believe there will be plenty of room for you to get in tonight. And the list is posted out. Is it by the registration table? On the message board. The list of confirmed RSVPs for the Film Fest is posted out there. Remember, this is a big deal. It's the American premiere. So even if you're not on the list, try to get there anyway. Lunch today, remember, there will be a network lunch in here. You simply come on in, you find the topic of your choice, and attend that lunch and have at it. Let's see, and also don't forget there'll be two important breakout sessions during that lunch. Really terrific panels, one on the Everglades restoration and one on dolphins, featuring Rick O'Berry, who, as you know, won the Oscar for his Tai Chi film. It'll be a terrific, terrific panel. And Angela has a very important announcement. Angela?
Yes, you guys. Thank you. You heard Dee Boersma talking about Galapagos briefly. The National Association of Hispanic Journalists has put together a wonderful panel on the Galapagos Islands, and a lot of the panelists came on their own dime to talk about the issues in those wonderful islands and to talk about the journalism, and that would be a great connection if you guys are interested in the Galapagos. These are the people to talk to. We are really proud of our partnership with the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. It's really like the first time we kind of condensate here together, and we hope SEJ and NHJ are going to continue to work together. So I just wanted to draw your attention to the panel tomorrow at 2 p.m. Thank you.
The panel is at 2 p.m. tomorrow, the Galapagos panel. It should be terrific. Absolutely. Peter Dykstra, one more quick word about the SEJ podium. Listen to what he's got on tap now.
It's a terrific panel, and if you like what you heard here, we have two more today, and they're both saltwater themed. At 4 o'clock, we have a commercial fisherman, Hans Jessett, who's a longliner from Australia, who says he's developed a smart hook that will greatly reduce the bycatch toll from longline fishing. And starting immediately across this floor on the far side at the news podium, the NGO Oceana We'll be talking about something that it's remarkable how much we've forgotten. Less than 2 years ago, we had a massive oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Regulations have been rewritten. Oceana has a critique of those regulations, which they say will not prevent another potential catastrophic spill, and that's starting immediately. So follow me over there if you want to hear them.
Bring your notepads, you guys. This is a news conference. Thank you all, panelists, very, very much. Thank you.